Welcome to the Falk Salem Podcast. Each month we'll bring you a mix of operational announcements and clinical pieces to keep you up to speed. Through our monthly podcast, our goal is to put the tools and education right in the palm of your hand. By keeping you up to date, we hope that we can empower you to continue bringing exceptional medical care to the city of Salem and beyond. Any and all material we release has been edited to comply with HIPAA standards.
Thanks for joining us today for this next focus section on pediatrics. Today, I want to take some time. I want to talk a little bit about the importance of APGAR scores in pediatrics and how we apply those scores, and maybe even some methods and some tools that we can use to try to remember just what those scores mean and how often we need to do them. So first off, the term APGAR is actually named after the doctor who devised this scoring system. It was developed in 1952 by Dr. Virginia APGAR, and it was used as a rapid method of assessing the clinical status of a newborn at specific time intervals to try to understand if we need to do supportive care with breathing for this newborn. You know, it's really important to know that the methodologies of, as far as like human birth, have evolved quite a bit, especially in about the last 100 years. I mean, even though this is something that, I mean, obviously has been around for as long as our species has, we're still really dialing in like how this process like works as a rescuer, or how we can interface into that situation. That is a very natural thing that can occur, but when things go wrong, how do we help? How do we figure out if this is a natural thing that's happening in this birthing situation, or if something is going wrong and we need to make an intervention? You know, it should really also be tempered with, as rescuers, you know, we're always thinking about the worst case scenario. And during childbirth, things, they may look like an emergency that aren't an emergency. And we're already poised and ready to act. And if we look at this baby who comes out and is purple and, you know, like this maroon color, and they don't appear to be breathing very well, and their pulse oximetry score is really, really poor, and during that first minute, we're just trying to wrap our minds around, is this normal or is this not? We suddenly get this urge to over-treat that individual, or to start providing interventions to that, you know, new baby, because nobody wants to see anything bad happen in that situation. Nobody wants to be, you know, behind the progression of what's going on. We're ready to act. We're just trying to figure out, when do we act? Is this normal or is this not? And we've been trying to do that, you know, for hundreds of years as we've started applying medicine to this. And, you know, there's schools of thought about natural birth and about interventions that allow the birthing process to become easier. You know, I mean, there's still some practices that, you know, have use of opioids, you know, to help with pain. And some of those interventions like cross over to the infant as the infant is being born. So now we have an infant who is being affected by opioids. That absolutely will affect the respiratory cases or the respiratory components of this child. Anyways, like those sorts of things now add even more, you know, murkiness to the water here, as we're trying to see clearly what is going on with this child and what are we going to do about it. So the golden standard here are APGAR scores. And APGAR scores have been shown to have a really positive effect on helping to not only give rescuers something to grab onto here, a way to assess an infant who can't tell us what's going on, a way to physically look at signs and progression of skin tone, a progression of muscle tone, a progression of respirations, a progression of their reflexes that gives us something to hold on to that may show us an improvement over a period of time, even though in the moment we're kind of, okay, there's a baby that was just born. What do I need to do? Does this baby need aggressive suctioning? Do they need airway supportive measures? Does this baby need epinephrine? Do we need chest compressions? Like, where are we at in this? So, you know, the Apgar score is comprised of five main components. The first one is going to be the color. So this is going to be the pallor of that infant. Blue, cyanotic, red, pink, like starting to pink up, especially in the mucosa, like around the mouth and the lips, in the extremities as well. The second component is the heart rate. What does the heart rate look like? And it's really important to understand that a fast heartbeat in a newborn is okay. Too fast may eventually become a problem, but their heart rate that's how they control their blood pressure. They really don't have other mechanisms of like vasoconstriction that have been developed at all. They are rate-based creatures. So they maintain their blood pressure by speeding up their heart. And actually, kids do really well with things like epinephrine or things like that because their vasculature is perfect. They don't have any constriction, or they haven't been to McDonald's too many times, or at least by this particular point. And, you know, that heart rate is how they're controlling their blood pressure. So we want to see that heart rate improve. And bradycardia in a child, especially bradycardia that's persistent, may be something that is a critical sign that we want to look for. The third component here we want to look at is the child's reflexes. And as those reflexes start to develop and as those reflexes start to improve, as the child becomes more aware, as their nervous system really starts getting plugged in, and as that child starts to wake up from what has been going on with it here after delivery, there's first few breaths that's really going to start to activate their body here. Over a period of time, we might start seeing their reflexes kick in. And then the fourth component here is their muscle tone. You might see both of those pieces really starting to support one another. And then the fifth one is going to be respiration. So the child may start with, you know, poor respirations that might improve to, or hopefully improves to, much more strong respirations, and hopefully a very strong, productive cry that really helps them to open up the lungs, move any mucus that might be there, helps them to expectorate any fluid that they might have had there in their passages. And not only that, but that breathing, it actually has some components on changing the infant's flow of blood inside of their body. And it actually is a stimulation on closing off some holes that are inside of the heart. The thought here right now is we use this Apgar score to watch these qualities in color, heart rate, reflexes, muscle tone, and respiration, and we give that a score. And that score is either a 0 if it's the worst case scenario, or a 1 if it's kind of there and it's starting to get better, or 2 if it has finally gotten to the point where it has reached what would be normal for that infant. So we're looking at this clinical sign, and let's discuss this on a matter of like color, right? So like if we're thinking about the color of the child is blue, cyanotic, maybe even like pale or like this mottled waxy sort of like a color as it comes out, that's going to be a 0, right? And as time progresses, what we want to see, especially as that child starts taking breaths and as their heart starts to move that blood around and the heart rate increases and all that, is we're going to start seeing that baby start to pink up over the course of time. So as that pink nature starts to come in, maybe they're a little bit more blue on the extremities, but they're pink along the core and along their face. Great, then that might be a 1. And then as soon as they're pinked up all the way through, then that would be a full score of 2. So if you're starting to kind of see how this scoring system works, The lower the score, the more critical the patient is. And the other piece on this graph we have to start thinking about is that this is also a comparison over time. So at the time of birth up to that 1 minute of age, you know, they've been alive for 1 minute, they may have a pretty low Apgar score. But by a couple of minutes in, we want to see this score improve by 5 minutes, right? Then not only that, we want to do 5 minute intervals over the course of 20 minutes to see this score get better and better and better, right? Especially if we're starting to see this child really get better and then suddenly become worse, it might help us to trend if something hasn't closed off, like that hole in their heart that we were just kind of talking about, or if they have some sort of like mucus in their lungs that maybe is already causing problems, or a developmental anomaly that wasn't known about that is starting to, you know, affect the ability for this child to respirate, perfuse. We're going to start seeing that by using this Apgar score and kind of predict what needs to be done or activate different resources or things like that. So let's get into a little bit more about, you know, kind of, you know, the processes of how we do this. It's adopted by not only EMS, this is used in the hospital, this is used by doulas and nurse midwives who, you know, may be assisting with like a home delivery. This is that golden standard of how we would even communicate between one provider to another. So imagine you come into a imminent delivery and, you know, you get this information, you've been trending your Apgar scores, we're transporting to the hospital. We need to even communicate to them the urgency of what we're seeing here, right? Just saying that, you know, the baby appears to be, you know, having problems breathing, that paints a specific picture. But if I'm telling them that I have an Apgar score at 20 minutes that's 7 or less, that is a severe sign that this patient has some sort of a pathology that needs to be addressed. That is going to activate a lot of resources, and it's going to get a lot of experts moving to your location so that they can immediately get involved and try to make an intervention, right? It also tells us that if we are making interventions and things are staying low, maybe we need to readdress those interventions. Maybe we're missing something. Something I've learned in my career, like right off the bat, is babies get cold very quickly. Skin-to-skin contact is huge when it comes to children. When children get cold, they tend to do much, much worse in dealing with this new life that they've kind of picked up on here. And now that they're out and about trying to just do the best that they can, anything we can do to keep that baby warm is critical to their success. Not only that, but that skin-to-skin contact, especially with mom, is also a great way to affect mom positively in all of this. So let's say in our scenario here, we've removed baby from mom, we're trying to resuscitate baby. Baby is slowly getting better, but hasn't quite reached the peak of where we would want it to be. Maybe we should consider some skin-to-skin contact. Maybe that shared body heat, sort of a stimulus there. There's a lot to be said about some of even those treatments that we may not be thinking about in EMS or thinking about in the field, because we're protocol-based creatures. We look at things of, all right, cool, I can use hot packs, I can use these Mylar space blankets, I can use that little hat, we can oxygenate a patient. There's other resources that we might want to use too. All right, so let's climb into the Apgar scores here. So the 5 minute Apgar score is of 7 to 10 can be a reassuring sign that the patient is progressing. At 5 minutes, if they are less than 7, this patient is sick. A score of 4 to 6 is moderately abnormal, and it really puts us in this mode of we might need to do some supportive care for this child. And a score of 0 to 3 in a term or even a late preterm infant, this is a critical sign of what we would see here. So remember, like when we're talking about these scores, let's talk about those things that we're looking at. So in a score of 0 to 3, that means that within the first 5 minutes, they're probably still blue, waxy, white, mottled. They're bradycardic. They have little to no respiratory effort. They have no muscle tone, and they have no reflexes, right? Reflexes being things like they pull their arms and legs away from like painful stimulus. Perhaps they are doing things and just reacting to the world around them as they're stimulated. And then their muscle tone, they don't have anything. They're just floppy. At 5 minutes, that's 5 minutes that this child has been bradycardic. That's 5 minutes this child might be hypoxic or has poor perfusion. That should paint a picture that in a patient who was full term, I mean, that's sort of a sign right there. We're going to need to do something to support that person. At 4 to 6, an APGAR of 4 to 6, maybe this child has more like modeling on their arms and their legs, but their core appears to be perfusing. That's good. Maybe they are borderline bradycardic, right? So we're scoring a couple of points there. They're not as speedy as I would like them to be. So they're, you know, 120 beats per minute or less, maybe 120 to 100 beats per minute. A little bit more on the concerning side, but not quite in the dumps just yet. But maybe they have really poor muscle tone. They have really poor reflexes at 5 minutes. Right? And maybe their respirations just aren't as strong as we need to see them. Maybe there's like rancorous sort of respirations. Maybe there's still mucus in the airway or something like that. So at 5 minutes, the baby's trying, but hasn't fully recovered or hasn't really fully moved into perfusing as good as they could. Now, this can be moderately abnormal. So there may be an intervention. There may be something there that we can do to help this child improve even better. Maybe that's suctioning. Maybe that's actively warming and drying and stimulating this child even more. Maybe this is that body heat, that bonding moment of having that skin-to-skin contact with mom that we might need to have there. Maybe this child needs some passive oxygenation just to improve a little bit more of their perfusion and really wake up that brain and get that get those stimuluses firing off in the brain that makes that child angry enough to cry loudly, to move the mucus, to open up those lungs and use them for the first time, right? And that score of 7 to 10, right? Because remember, we're evaluating those 5 different pieces and the max score is 2 points for every one of those pieces. A max score would be 2 to color, 2 to heart rate, 2 to reflexes, 2 to muscle tone, and 2 to respirations. That would be a child who looks to be fully woken up, is perfusing. Maybe they still look a little blue. Maybe that child has a little bit of modeling there. Maybe they don't have the loudest cry that we've ever heard, but they've got a great heart rate. They've got good muscle tone. They're for lack of a better term, they are angry. They are trying their best with their muscle tone. And at the 5 minute mark, that score of 7 to 10 is really reassuring that we're all, whatever it is we're doing it the right way and the child is improving, right? So the persistently low APGAR scores alone, right? It is a sign that this patient has some sort of a problem, right? Now, what that problem is, that could be a variety of things. It's just like any other patient. Why is a patient cyanotic, right? That patient is cyanotic because they were in the pool for a while or they were cold, right? That patient can be cyanotic because they have poor respirations. But is that because they took, you know, an opioid, or is that because they have COPD, right? Is that because they have like an ongoing pneumonia or they have a PE? There's so many pathologies in there that give us that sign of cyanosis, right? With children, that same premise is still there. They just don't have some of the same pathologies that we would be looking for in like an adult, someone who's, you know, developed these pathologies in another way. This child may just have something else that is causing this, right? The big major things, though, that we want to look at with this kid is their environmental interface. So that's going to be, are they dry? Are they warm? Are we trying to keep them warm? And are they being stimulated tactilely across their body? That stimulus, that pain response that we're giving that child, whether that's flicking the bottoms of the feet or vigorously kind of like rubbing with a towel, that sort of activity level like that, it sends signals to the brain. It wakes up the brain. And the child's reaction to that causes them to breathe deeper, breathe stronger. What this should really sound like is we're causing epinephrine to be released inside of that child, right? We're doing that with natural stimulus of the environment, and that stimulates them to breathe. It stimulates them to improve their blood pressure, to improve their heart rate. And we're doing that in a natural way as that child is born. So that environmental interface there is something that we can improve. When we're troubleshooting this child and we're looking at the potential cause of the problem, look at it that way. Is the child receiving enough stimulus from outside, right? If the child's being actively warmed, if the child is being actively stimulated and those sorts of things, now let's also look environmentally. How do we have the child laid out? Maybe there is something else here that is not allowing that child to breathe. Remember, the physiologic difference in a child is that they have this larger occiput on the back of the head, right? And it forces that child, when they lay supine, to close off their airway or move their anatomy into a position that can sometimes compromise breathing or at least just make breathing a bit more difficult. How about we pad under the shoulders? We put that child into a sniffing position where that mandible is kind of forced forward just a bit. Their head is slightly, it's in line, but it's kind of slightly tilted back. The nose is in that sniffing position. And that's going to help to align the anatomy that while this child is trying to take its first few breaths, while this child is trying to open up those lungs and move this mucus or, you know, just understand what it feels like to breathe, we're making that easier for them. Right. On top of that, as far as like the environmental like aspect on this, you know, with all of those pieces, you know, the child's probably going to be breathing in ambient air, and that's going to be fine at first. Eventually, though, that child might need supportive oxygen care. Right. So what is our FiO2 that we're kind of giving to this patient? If we're just trying to use a BVM, that's going to use ambient oxygenation that's around us at 21%, right? This is where things like the neonatal resuscitation program, the NRP, steps in, and they start talking about using an oxygen blender. And this is a concept that is really foreign to us in EMS. Maybe eventually this, you know, might be something that, you know, people could look into, but our answers, at least as far as protocols, are almost always great. We're either going to bag them with a self-inflating device. That's what a BVM is. It's a self-inflating respirator, which means it doesn't have to have an oxygen source attached to it. And we can use that to self-inflate it and then deliver ambient oxygen without an oxygen source. But in EMS, we almost always plug that into an oxygen source. We're going to deliver that at 100% oxygen, and we're going to start bagging that into a patient. That may not be what, you know, this child needs right off the bat. Maybe what they need is they need a blend, a higher FiO2 concentration. That's really hard for us to do in EMS in a standard ambulance layout. Now, inside of like the NICUs, or inside of like the labor and delivery decks at hospitals, this is part of their resuscitation program. This is part of their training. At specific intervals, based on the Apgar scores, if we're going to give supportive breaths to this child, they're going to use an oxygen blender to blend the oxygen to a lower level. Maybe that's somewhere between like 30 and 40% oxygen, and it's not 100% FiO2. You know, there's been some studies and some things that have been done that shows a negative side effect of oxygen, which is kind of a strange thing to say at first. But when we start to understand that oxygen does have consequences when we use it at higher concentrations, especially in infants, right? That is something that we need to understand a little bit more. So let's talk about that here briefly. So overall, the thought is about use of oxygen during resuscitation is that studies have shown that use of 100% oxygen increases the load of oxygen-free radicals inside of the bloodstream, and that starting resuscitation at 21% oxygen or ambient room air had a significantly lower mortality rate at 1 week and at 1 month with infants in comparison to infants who were initially resuscitated with 100% oxygen. Now, this needs to be tempered with the fact that if the child continues to show a heart rate of less than 60, if the child over the course of time is showing the respiratory compromise, is showing that they're having respiratory failure, we eventually get to the point of using 100% oxygen in this child. Like, I'm not trying to say that the use of oxygen is wrong. What I'm trying to say is that we need to temper our initial resuscitation efforts with a child with understanding that ambient air may be good to start with for the first few minutes of this resuscitation. After a while, though, we're going to need to increase our concentration of oxygen to match the level of need or urgency that we're seeing. And using the Apgar score can give us that information. So remember that that Apgar score is going to happen at 1 minute. It's going to happen at 5 minutes. And then every 5 minutes after that, for the next 20 minutes, we're going to have this Apgar score. We want to see them increasing to eventually getting to the point of an Apgar of 10 or somewhere between 7 and 10 and anywhere between 4 and 6. You know, it gives us an idea that this child may be having poor perfusion or poor respiratory performance, right? So when we're using this and we're starting to think about what our interventions might be, you know, we've looked at the environmental stuff. Now we've looked at, great, maybe we just need to increase more of their ambient oxygen. That might be blow-by oxygen. That might be a small nasal cannula. That also might be something like BVM interventions. Now we start also thinking about other things that we could do with this child, right? If we're looking at our respiratory efforts and they're being compromised because this child still has fluid in the nostrils, in the mouth, right? We want to suction those things out. We want to try to get the fluid out of the of those passageways and try to open those passageways up. So being aggressive with your suctioning and really cleaning things out is good. Looking for things like meconium staining, right? That's going to be that first bowel movement that the child has. Meconium is byproducts of digestion that have occurred in utero that sometimes get released during the birthing process and it mixes with the amniotic fluid. Remember that while the child was in utero, that child is basically underwater the whole time, and that fluid is actively exchanging in their passageways and is, you know, covering everything. That meconium is a pretty sticky, gross substance. And that meconium getting inside of their airways may lead to things like infections. If we can, to trying to prevent getting that into their lungs, we need to suction the nose and the mouth and get that fluid out of there. If we're still noticing more of that there, we might need to suction out more. I don't want to positively pressurize ventilate this child who has meconium staining in their mouth, or meconium staining here without looking in their mouth and removing any additional pieces there. Otherwise, I'm just bagging this stuff into their lungs, and that's not going to be good for a longer period of time, right? Thinking back on those scores that we're looking for, if our respirations, we know we've suctioned out well, we're now maybe providing positive pressure ventilations with increasing amounts of oxygen that we're giving to that person up to 100%. You know, this person might eventually also need something like chest compressions. So when we're thinking about how we're taking vital signs and how we're measuring this, a pulse ox score is always going to be low on these children. It's going to be low for a while. We're going to need to be comfortable with abnormally low pulse oximetry on a child, and it's really unreliable, other than to say that when we have it on there, we should see it improving. But it may be normal to see a pulse ox score in the 70s with this child for a while, but then eventually it starts to improve. Eventually it starts to get a little bit better, but we're never really going to see it get up to that nice, comfortable pleth wave 100% right now with this child. A better indicator that this child is perfusing is that coloration, that pallor change, right? That difference between being cyanotic, pale, waxy, blue, especially in the mucosa, like around the lips and in the mouth, those sorts of areas like that, they need to be pinking up if we're perfusing well. The other thing that we can use that pulse oximetry score for is their heart rate. We start looking at that heart rate, maybe throw on your 4-lead EKG to even get a better idea of their heart rate. Anything less than 100, that child is doing poorly. Now, initially, when that baby is born, during that first minute, while we're just starting to stimulate them, get them to cry, drying them off, doing things like that, that heart rate may be, you know, on the lower side. We need to see that recover quickly, because all of our efforts with respiration really mean nothing if the heart isn't pumping well enough. That might mean that we need to initiate chest compressions and give that body a jump start to allow this ischemic tissue a chance to not become fully ischemic to the point of infarcting, right? And this is really kind of the goal with this resuscitation piece, is over the course of the next 20 minutes, we're trying to prevent this patient from having a encephalopathy thanks to hypoxia. I don't want this child to have brain damage associated with hypoxia. I don't want this child to have organ failure associated with hypoxia. So we're looking for signs that things are improving, but if that heart rate's not improving, that is a critical sign that we are not moving blood at the rate at which it needs to be moved. Which means that if we're gonna start doing chest compressions, we're gonna be doing a fast set of chest compressions at a rate of 100 to 120 beats per minute, right? This is gonna be fast. This is gonna be something that we are trying to move the blood and get it to where it needs to be so that the child's own epinephrine, the child's own catecholamines are being released to get them to continue that engine on its own, right? It's kind of like push starting a car, if you will. So when we're thinking about that, at that 1 minute mark, if we're really not seeing good heart rate, we may need to take over for that patient. Eventually, we might even get to the point where this child needs to be intubated. That child may need to be intubated and then further suctioned down that ET tube. These sorts of things might also help us to provide positive pressure ventilations. A scenario where this might be really important, something that we don't train enough in EMS or even really think about, again, comes from that NRP course. In preterm infants, it's possible that they are so preterm that they actually haven't produced their own surfactant in their lungs, meaning that their lungs are stiff or their lungs don't have that same lubricant inside of them that allows them to fully expand and contract smoothly, which means that as this infant is fighting to breathe, that bag is just sticking to itself, or it's inflexible so much in its breathing. That means that we might end up needing positive pressure ventilations, less on a BVM and more on an ET tube. And there are treatments that can be done, like giving surfactant down the ET tube to this infant if they're a neonate, if they're a preemie sort of a situation. Having that tube in place allows them to administer surfactant down the tube there. Recognizing that preterm infant becomes really critical in some of our initial assessments. How far along are you? Was there any known problems with your care? Have you been receiving prenatal care for this pregnancy? Where was the placenta implanted? Is there any problem so far with identifying any signs of preeclampsia with this person? Have there been any signs of like fetal distress going on prior to this delivery, right? A sign that might be with some fetal distress would be mom hasn't felt the infant move in a long period of time. Ask anybody who's ever been pregnant before. The understanding of knowing how that baby moves and how that baby kicks certain things and rotates around and plays punching bags on sensitive things inside, that's an experience that they're very familiar with. They're also very quick to identify when they haven't felt that in a while, right? So understanding that if we're now delivering a child and they haven't felt that movement in a while, we may be dealing with a child who may need more aggressive resuscitation, especially if they are preterm in their potential delivery here. So to kind of summarize and to wrap up here, understanding your Apgar scores is really, really important. These Apgar scores are great communication tools to get other rescuers on the same page with where we're at, and also to give them an understanding of how this resuscitation or how this birth has progressed. If we trended these out on a graph, you might see them plateau, you might see them start to degrade. That should give us a clue that we need to be more aggressive with some of our treatments that we may be doing for this infant, right? It may be giving us an idea that this infant might even need epinephrine to help us to resuscitate them. That's something else we got to think about here. Either way, these Apgar scores are also showing us if things are getting better. Okay, maybe I don't need to give these interventions just now. Maybe I need to look at a few of the environmental things that I can do to help support that patient in their care, right? So that might be something just like aggressively drying them off or getting skin-to-skin contact with mom. If the child can suckle or if the child is able to nurse, that actually has a lot of beneficial things for mom with helping her to stop bleeding. So there's a couple of things there that we should throw out into all of this, but I really also want to use this as a plug to encourage paramedics to expand your scope a bit. I challenge you to take the NRP if you can. Find a course around here. It's going to be like drinking from a fire hose. The information is great, and it's not as EMS friendly as you might hope, in that it's really geared towards in-hospital resuscitations. But there are a lot of lessons that we can extrapolate from this. Understanding what preterm delivery looks like and understanding how maybe unprepared we are for preterm delivery in the field, and that this is going to be something that's going to take a village for us to try to handle. Also having just hands-on practice with folks who work in L&D, understanding what are their expectations from EMS, sitting across the table from a labor and delivery nurse or even a nurse midwife who's working in the field will also contrast so much of what we do in the field. I remember when I took NRP, I had a great conversation with a nurse midwife and a doula who were there just recertifying a class that they personally have to have. And we were talking, they're doing these deliveries at home, sometimes with, you know, out a whole lot of supportive care. They have a jump bag with all kinds of different medications and things like that in it. And their emergency plan was to call 911 and then tell the paramedic, this is what we were going to do. And if anybody has worked in EMS, you can probably appreciate how that conversation is probably going to go. We get dispatched to a house, and here's somebody who's there who's attempting to resuscitate a child or is having a complicated delivery. We tend to be very type A. We tend to be very aggressive on scenes. And now we're dealing with a neonate here, and that nurse or that midwife may have some really good information and good training to be able to help us with that resuscitation. But we have to be able to speak their lingo. We have to be able to understand what they're talking about. And we also have to be able to coach them about our protocol and what we are allowed to do or what we can do or what we carry. There was a big disparity when I was talking to those two about what we actually carry on the ambulance and how often we practice intubation on children, which is next to nothing, by the way. You know, and it's one of those things that it really started to contrast. Even when we get to L&D, what kind of information are they looking for? The typical trauma report, the typical medical report we're giving in the ER, that's not going to cut it. We need to be speaking to the point even quicker. We need to be delivering this information even better. So taking the class like NRP will really help you to appreciate the complexity of what exists underneath there. This may be one of those cases that you may never see it in your entire career, but if you ever did, you wouldn't want to get it wrong. And you definitely would want to be as prepared as you could to interface in that side of that kind of a situation. So again, the challenge is out there. I recommend people take the neonatal resuscitation program. There's tons of information and things that go well beyond our scope, but it is great information. It is really important information that if you ran into it in the field, you would be 10 steps ahead of where we're at here now. So thank you so much for listening. Thanks for taking the time to think about these sorts of things here with me. And as always, please have a safe shift. Thanks for listening to the Falk Salem Podcast. We welcome any feedback you may have, or if you have suggestions for future content, please send an email to Nicholas, that's N-I-C-H-O-L-A-S, .vaneps, V-A-N-E-P-P-S, @falk.com. Thank you for all your hard work and have a safe shift.